All right, maybe we are today's quorum. That will be too bad for those people who didn't want to talk about the papers, since I'm going to talk about the papers. That's not your problem, since you're here. I'll ask for questions in a moment, and then I want to return to the First Amendment in mid-sentence, where we were when we broke. But first, about your writing. The end of next week would be a good time, which doesn't mean it's a necessary time. There will be, assuming that the enrollment is actually what it claims to be rather than who is here today, there will be 68 papers in this bunch and 38 papers in my first-year bunch, all arriving next week. That's 100,000 words to edit before we go back to your rewriting and your second paper and the rewriting of the second paper. So I have just one quarter of my semester's editing burden to do. And if you get it in a little early, then you'll get it back a little earlier, and then you can rewrite it a little earlier. But I am not disturbed about exactly when your essay arrives, because, as you see, I will have sufficient work to do without you. So this should not be regarded as yet another one of those pointless timed exercises. And if you were planning to ask me exactly when is it due, then I will say it is relatively good if it is in next week, and that's the best answer you can get from me. I will put up this evening the template on the front page, so that if you haven't worked with me before, you will know. You can just click and it'll make the paper in the correct name, file it in the correct place, etc., etc., and all you need to do is to start typing. The idea is yours. The words must be fewer than 1,000 under all circumstances. Those are the rules. You're writing for the web, and if you don't choose to make it private, you can go and take two characters out at the bottom, and then it will be just you and me who read it. But if you don't want to make it private, then because you're writing for the web, link to things instead of making footnotes or dropping URLs in ugly ASCII text at the bottom of the page or whatever. Just make it possible for the reader to click once and go to wherever it is that substantiates whatever you're saying. I assume that there are things to write about surveillance and the Fourth Amendment and the history of constitutional law, and that there are things to write about not the government, but all the stuff from last semester about private entities and Google and Facebook and so on. And as I will try and suggest in a moment, there might be something to write about what happens when a nation of 44 million modern people suddenly becomes aware of the fact that the invading army has everything that's in their mobile phones and on their iCloud accounts, which you might want to think about for an instant. It could be you. And I'm sure there are lots of other topics as well, so you'll choose, and I'll read what you have to say and try and understand your idea as clearly as I can, and then see if together we can make it better. Questions about essays? This is all clear and straightforward. Many of you have worked with me before, you know the drill, but just in case. Any other questions? All right, good. So sometime in the next 10 days or later if you need to for whatever reason, and sooner is better than later, and I'll start working on the first things that arrive, and I will be working until sometime in May. But, you know, they don't have to be your draft. All right, good. Now, about materials, places we were last week or in weeks before, questions, comments, assertions. I walked in here and Matt had every seat in the room filled and it was just as silent, and I thought, turns out I'm not the only one. Yeah?
So, Professor, obviously a lot's happened in the last week.
I'd like to be Evan if it's at all possible. Not only professor. Yeah, there has been a lot of stuff in the past week. God knows.
To be honest, one of your previous sort of lectures discussed how these, you know, so-called watchers are more concerned at looking at us than they are at each other, the U.S. and Russia. It doesn't seem to me like it seems hard to reconcile that with sort of what's happened, and also really
because I'm sorry, I don't understand the connection.
Because the U.S. I mean, U.S. intelligence. was, you know, I think took a pretty big risk over this last week in sort of, and was a risk which paid off, which is correct, in sort of disclosing what Russia was doing in a way that was, it seems to me, not a malevolent act, but quite a sort of a genuine attempt to prevent this invasion and to sort of warn Ukraine about it.
And so, if I can, I'm not yet sure I understand the conclusion. So it felt more like a spy versus spy world to you this past week than spy versus people.
Yes.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I would have thought that we would agree that at a time when the two heaviest teams in this world were in direct conflict with one another, and one of the things that was happening was nuclear alert levels were being adjusted, that this would be as classic a moment of conflict between the services as you could possibly imagine. That's true. This past month, not week, has been for the services what they have rarely seen since 1985. Namely, a great power confrontation from the battlefield in Europe to the submarines beneath intercontinental waters. And the question that is the single most serious question for the services on both sides, what are the capabilities and intentions of the adversary, has been at the front row. So one thing you might be saying, which I would agree about, and probably even the predecessor at the podium would agree about, is that this is as apparently classic a moment of Cold War intelligence confrontation as we've seen in decades. That's true. And yet even this one is different for precisely the reason that you have explained, or at least referred to, which is that the United States has been operating during the past month in direct collision with the fundamental premise of intelligence activity, which is never tell anybody anything without a good reason. The civilian command of the United States gave a good reason and decided to treat the product of its intelligence services with what might, under other circumstances, have seemed casual disregard for the protection of sources and methods of intelligence. It was actually cannier than that, and it was in no way a continuation of the hostility between the White House and the services which characterized the preceding administration. But it was a fundamental change in the understanding on the part of the United States government about what to do with the extraordinary amount of intelligence that has ordinarily preceded American decision-making at times like these with respect to this adversary. The giving away of such an extraordinary depth and breadth of information that the Americans possessed about capabilities and intentions on the other side, delivered to the public in almost real time, is an extraordinary change. And if you're going to concentrate on this part of it, on the intelligence services in their relation to government part of it, then it's also relatively important to notice that this is not their father's Cold War. The discussion in the State of the Union address last night was deflective about this as it was about just about everything else. Mr. Biden was careful to take credit for the way in which the United States government had behaved differently and even for how it had used its intelligence differently, but he didn't describe it and he certainly didn't suggest that it was a change in long-term realities, though it was. He did make clear, as other sources did throughout the week, that both the CIA director and the DNI were personally engaged in, indeed they were said to have thought up, this strategy of releasing intelligence. That was designed to emphasize the degree to which the services and their commanding officer in the White House were on the same page about doing this, that this wasn't merely political actors deciding to throw a lot of intelligence around. So it both reaffirms, as you say, the importance of systemic intelligence collection, particularly in the context geopolitically and militarily which we built the national security state for, and it also shows something about the modification of process in this new place where we are. It's important to recognize that one of the reasons for this is the control of information and the absence of a right to publish on the Russian side. What the Americans have been doing in the past month by releasing intelligence is perfectly complementary to the extraordinary activity of the Russian government in trying to keep its population believing that there is no war. So it would be right to say, in a way, that what is happening is an intensification of the conditions of the Cold War intelligence confrontation on both sides. The Americans are giving things away that would never have been given away before, and the Russians are attempting to keep a tighter lid on the understanding about the activity of their armed forces in securing the security and peace of the motherland than they have ever tried before, even under Stalin. Those are both extraordinary developments. They are both keys to the state of the new world. And the important point about that is that the Americans have made a pretty good demonstration so far that they can afford to give away far more intelligence than the Russians can afford to tell the truth to their people, and that this is only going to increase over time. With respect to how the Americans released intelligence, it is also true that there was great artfulness about it. And if you want to play the inside baseball of it, you can see some very fine work going on. They were, of course, far more generous with their contribution of signals intelligence and satellite photography to the world than they were to any indications of human intelligence around Putin or around his government. They didn't burn any sources. They didn't kill any spies. They were operating within parameters which are characteristic of the way professional intelligence services work. There was just a whole lot more of what was in the president's daily brief told to the European governments and the people of the world than under other circumstances. I'm still not exactly sure where that gets us with respect to the stuff that interests us. Please help me.
I think it seems hard to believe that U.S. intelligence and sort of Russian intelligence would now or ever anywhere in the near future cooperate on sort of surveillance of U.S. citizens or are participating in this kind of this intelligence in the same way.
I'm not sure that I understand the point of that comment. That Russian and American intelligence cooperate a great deal, as all intelligence services do. They exist in a rich trade of truth and falsehood. And they are constantly engaged with one another, and they have some common adversaries. So it is not correct that they don't do business with one another, though they are not doing business with one another now. War stops that trade. But whatever is the dynamic between FSB and CIA, or for that matter, between military intelligence services, which is far more important at the moment. The most important dialogue occurring at the moment is occurring between people whose job it is to look at one another's nuclear command and control systems. Those are, on the one hand, among the most secretive parts of the institutions, but they are also, at the moment, the ones in which the professionals on both sides want to use every byway and back channel that they have to keep one another effectively informed, because everybody understands what a mistake could cost at the moment. And so there is actually some fairly interesting, if not entirely trusting, dealing going on between the hard-bitten professionals on both sides, in the military industrial services in particular, and the defense intelligence services in particular. Tsar Vladimir made a television program out of the use of non-specific words. Special combat duty in the deterrent services were not words of art. They weren't words of formal doctrine. They weren't words contained in documents that each side knows the other side has read. He was being deliberately nonspecific. There are obvious reasons for that, one of which is he's bluffing, and the other one of which is he isn't, and a series of in-betweens. That's been the most important intelligence target in the American world for the past 4 days. Everything that can be brought to bear on that question has been brought to bear on that question. And as is typical of the nuclear war arrangements of these powers, keeping the people from seeing any of it going on is among the most important parts. Nothing to see here. That's been the position of the United States government in every respect concerning the Soviet nuclear alert. But it would be a mistake on our parts as citizens, and in particular citizens of New York City, it would be particularly mistaken on our part not to notice that our nuclear adversary is on a higher state of alert than it has been any time in the last 4 decades. And what is going on in the intelligence shows, back and front, real and fake, is definitely related to that subject. The pitch of concern has not been higher in the lifetimes of most of the people doing this work right now. Again, I'm still not sure what this brings us most to and what we're discussing, but help me to understand.
I was thinking in relation to this note of Butcher's, not today's.
Well, okay, I mean, every statement made in 2013 is now inoperative in some context, but let us ask about what I had to say then and what Snowden had to say then about this. What is it that we should be thinking about? How the governments are using their tools? How many of the people in this room do they care about? I don't know. At most, I would guess right now two, but there may be somebody here whose involvements I don't know about. If you are contributing to aid for Ukrainians in the local networks in New York City or at Columbia University, are they paying close attention now? No, I don't think so. When asked to give some advice on that subject over the weekend, my position was you still have a couple of days to learn some security practices because the teams are busy right now, but they will get around to you pretty soon. If you're asking whether Chinese listening on the Columbia campus is at a higher level than usual, the answer is yes, but not by much because the level of listening is very high. But I would suggest that it would be more beneficial to get one step further back and to remember that most people thought that Ukrainian smartphones didn't have anything in them of any importance to anybody 14 days ago. Because the likelihood that something in the neighborhood of 200,000 soldiers were going to have guns in their hands looking for people inside Ukraine wasn't very high. It is now very high. If you were previously involved in human rights or humanitarian work in Crimea in 2014, and you were living and working for an NGO in Kiev last week, your phone is deadly to you. Literally. I don't know if you remember when our friends in Germany, the Chaos Hackers Club, created at the beginning of the most recent Iraqi wars specialized IEDs which only exploded when an American passport came. It was a nice sort of working demonstration of why it is that putting near-field communications chips in passports might not be such a good idea. You don't know how to disable the NFC chip in your passport, do you? You can hit it hard with a hammer, but a couple of 10 or 15 seconds in a microwave oven until you see the little hovering purple spark above the place where the chip is would be good. You will get stopped at borders thereafter, but at least your passport will be telling everybody who you are everywhere you go. The problem of 21st century life for people who suddenly find themselves under attack by authoritarian government, whether their own or somebody else's, is that you've already given away everything. Your tradecraft becomes useless because they've already got it. But just consider for a moment, if you think of constitutional law as a kind of alternative to individual planning about freedom, that is, after all, what it's supposed to be, right? In our sort of social contractarian idea of what constitutional law is, there's some stuff you don't have to worry about because the Fourth Amendment says, or the First Amendment says, or Article 3 says, or whatever, and so your freedom is not solely your own responsibility. But as I have tried to suggest here in the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment, and as I think we are now talking about when we think about what goes on over the next couple of weeks in Ukraine, the reality is that those pre-existing bargains in favor of your freedom, they're not perfect insurance policies, and every once in a while you begin to understand why they're not only not perfect, they're not good enough. It became, after about 2009 and a half, it became possible to find everybody in the Netherlands within 8 seconds. Please remember to swipe off the tram. The hardest time to find any human beings in an advanced society is during rush hour in the middle of a city. People move around a lot, and the carrying capacity of most surveillance structures that aren't built for the process of locating individual targets gets overwhelmed, and it gets a little difficult to find people during rush hour. Please remember to swipe off the tram. The adoption of point A to point B swiping on public transportation so that you swipe out as well as in was the last geometrical piece falling into place with respect to the ability to locate people within under a minute in advanced societies. When I asked young lawyers in the Netherlands about that in 2010, they were largely unconcerned. After all, we are the young lawyers in the justice ministry. Nobody would do anything wrong, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know whether that's still true because I haven't been in Amsterdam in 2 years, but I certainly hope soon to have a chance to find out. I would hope that the level of concern had gone up a little. It should have done. What we've seen in the past week in Ukraine is not the bad part yet. We saw the good part. Over the next several weeks, we'll see cities surrounded and literally besieged. We'll see an awful lot of urban destruction. I have no idea whether it will be worse than the destruction elsewhere in the world that we have become accustomed to. The only thing I know is that it can be. If the Russian army actually decides to use air-fueled munitions inside cities, nobody has ever seen anything. But in addition to all of that pounding, all of that destruction of infrastructure, I don't know whether Tsar Vladimir is actually willing to make Kiev look like Grozny. I've seen Grozny. But whatever happens in that hellscape of urban besiegement and infrastructure destruction and mass casualties, we will also see Spetsnaz out looking for people to kill, not just the president. He was quite right about that. They have long lists, and they know who to look for, and they know what their social media feeds are full of, and they know everybody who knows them. And even if they've ditched their phones, it's just a matter of time. And naturally, I think that ought to figure into people's calculations about what it's convenient to carry. I know that this is partly the result of being a Jew, right? Remember, I did 50% of all the Jews who lived in the 20th century, including me, 50% of all of us were murdered. So we're paranoid, OK? Okay, I grant that. And I have worked with this technology since I was a child, and I made lots of stuff that we live inside, and so I'm not only paranoid in the sense that I know what can be done to hurt people, I also understand how little you know about what you already use is doing to you. But here's a case. And I don't think the most important part of what to concentrate on is the literal 50,000 foot level of the Americans taking golf ball sized pictures of truck tires and gas cans lying on the road in the Ukraine, which they are doing. Right? And I don't think it's all the telephone calls in Moscow that they tapped in order to be able to say what the PR agencies and the disinformation guys were doing. I think that's all interesting. But I think the most important lesson in this for all of us is that 21st century life can turn into this overnight. And the technologies that you consider to be so useful are also the technologies that will exist for your destruction. There's one last piece of what is about to go on, which, or may be about to go on, which also touches upon our subject. Notwithstanding the nuclear saber rattling, and notwithstanding the sense that Tsar Vladimir is crazy, both of which I think are really important, I don't actually think that a nuclear strike on New York City is particularly likely. I think there are still good reasons not to do that. But after the central bank sanctions of last weekend, I'm not exactly sure what the reason is not to perform the widest possible and most destructive possible cyber attack on the United States financial system of which the Russians are capable. From Tsar Vladimir's point of view, that is the correct response. What the Americans did, or what the Americans caused all to do in the central bank sanctions, was an extraordinary event, a new form of coercion of the Russian state and its people, undoubtedly about to cause enormous amounts of harm. Good war fight. But also eliminating of any reason why he should be concerned that what we would do back would be harmful to him. What we would do back will be just more of what is already happening. We have removed most counter reasons for conducting an attack like that. I was talking after the last Iraq imbroglio with one of my friends at the edges of the American secret world, and we were talking about the first Iraq imbroglio. And he said, in the kind of conversation that intelligence mandarins have, the key word is, you may know more about this than I do, which is always the way in which mandarins explain how much they know. You may know more about this than I do, he said to me. But my understanding is that we decided in 1990 to go after Saddam Hussein's fortune and vaporize it, until we came to the conclusion that by doing so, we would destroy the Italian banking system. I didn't say, yeah, that's my understanding, because we were, of course, playing the game of you may know better than I about something I knew nothing whatever about, but I took his words seriously because he was in a position to know. And so I conclude that we crossed the line we previously had not been willing. The central bank sanctions risked collapses in the banking system, not only in Russia, but elsewhere in the world. And we are prepared to do that now because we need that much leverage and because a realignment within the American government about what is acceptable has occurred. I assume that means they are also carefully and thoughtfully aware of what the likelihoods are of response on the other side. And, of course, we're going to hear nothing about that until something serious occurs. But if all your worldly cash is in a smartphone wallet, I don't know about that. Do you? Any other questions about? Just goes to show how complicated life is. We don't even have any questions about that. Okay. time to time, we may have more to discuss. Questions about our actual topic of concern, this sentence or its Fourth Amendment equivalent? Places you want to go back over where we've been before I start again? Okay.
Actually, Professor, I had a question about what you meant about having...
I'd still rather be everybody. It's okay. I'm Professor.
Okay.
Go ahead.
About a money in a smart wallet in our following. Would that apply to, like, banking apps? Or, like?
Well, you tell me. What would happen in a sort of Jonathan Schell sense if instead of asking ourselves what will occur if a 150-kiloton nuclear warhead explodes over lower Manhattan, we ask ourselves instead, what would the best team in the world do for this, and it is for this, the best team in the world, what would the best team in the world do right now if it considered itself to be freed of political restriction because political leadership's view was the Americans destroyed our financial system, they deserve for us to destroy it back. What would you do? There are, of course, a certain number of places which constitute choke points that you would want to go after. And the skill of this team, the particular skill of this team, is in what the attackers of networks refer to as horizontal motion. That is, you get inside a network, how fast do you spread yourself throughout that network, systematically knocking over branches down to the leaves at the edges of the twigs, at the edges of the branches of the tree. This is where the Russian team excels. It moves quick inside networks. So you have pre-prepared a bunch of efforts. You have a bunch of beachheads that are of secondary benefit. You can't hold, maybe you can't even take primary assets for long. But you are really good at spreading yourselves down throughout the system. Where will you go? It's true that the infliction of maximum pain requires the ability to vaporize large amounts of money belonging to people who have a lot of money. But if you are attacking the United States, if your goal is to create a sense of this is too expensive, we can't do this, we should just let him do what he's going to do because we can't afford to pay this price, and if your goal is to demonstrate to the Americans that the price will be too high for them even if they never put a boot on the ground or a pilot in the air or even an American piece of hardware in the field, if you want to prove to them that the price will be paid at home, then certainly you want to begin the process of causing some kind of widespread consumer banking outages. Of course you do. Yes, the Americans are rich. They have deposit insurance. You are using accounts you decided to go to all the funds and all the dollar funds and all the not quite banks and all the Robin Hood accounts and all those places which are not covered by American deposit insurance. Yeah, they have CTFC insurance. Yeah, there are claims. Theoretically, you could get up to $500,000 back. But it's not like deposit insurance paid for by the banks. It's not cash in the hands of the Federal Reserve that can be paid out to people if a bank goes belly up overnight. And of course you want proof that you can reach inside Americans' pockets. So wouldn't you go and flatten a couple of those things if you had the ability to do so? Of course you would. Or rather, maybe you would if you're going to do it at all. But if you're going to do it at all, yeah, I don't think it would be particularly safe to assume that everybody's smartphone banking is going to work correctly on the morning after the attack. Of course it won't. It's not quite like taking 80% of all the currency in circulation in the economy out of action overnight secretly, however, right? It's not that you have to be a hostile power to do a thing like that. You could be your own government. Not this one, I don't think, but who knows? And Indian demonetization is not an absolutely bad indication of what will happen. And in fact, in the event of an attack on consumer banking. Who gets hurt? The poor get hurt. And that can be useful. So you would think of it as likely to occur in two discrete ways, one of which constitutes an attack on preferred targets to the extent that they're available. Colonial Pipeline was certainly an example of that. We went through an entire dress rehearsal of all of this, did we not, last year? The Russians wanted to demonstrate that by adequately interspersed attacks run by their own criminals, not their own government soldiers, but their own criminals, mind you, they could conceivably knock out energy production and food distribution in the United States from just one or two points, producing just a little bit of trouble. And in the raw logic of retaliation that Tsar Vladimir has been expressing over the past 10 days, we hadn't even done anything that harmful to them yet. One possibility is we should all rush out and buy diamonds immediately and put them in our hat. This is my community's ordinary response to such questions. Okay. Another possibility is we should thicken our collection of $100 bills. Another possibility is we should do nothing whatever. I'm not buying diamonds at the moment. More about this? No, I didn't say I was surprised that he hasn't. The days are all that have passed. If this is if the man is not completely insane, he's on schedule having done nothing yet. And deniability will be invoked, and it will take time. And this is not a short-term problem. If we were actually trying to guess what his calendar has marked on it about this, it wasn't to get it done by the 1st of March. But okay, Daniel. I'm sorry, so you wanted to say something?
No, you might be surprised, but
Yeah, it's not surprise. I'm just wondering, when does the other shoe drop?
Okay, so you think it's
Likely. I mean, none of us can know, and I certainly don't have access to the information that the decision makers are currently using with respect to the actual mental state of the Tsar. That's the most important question, and I have no insight whatever. I am assuming that we are still operating according to some rules of rational escalation. Under rules of rational escalation, this would be a logical escalation.
So I'm not sure about this, but...
None of us are sure about any of the things we're talking about here. That's not the condition of entry.
Right, but aren't governments actions in response to cyber warfare hard to predict because there's no really standard framework for governments to act under acts of aggression?
And therefore, we don't know what the Americans would
do. Or the Russians or anyone.
Well, but the Russians aren't acting in some fashion that requires us to understand their doctrinal playbook. They're responding to an attack. The only thing that would be unexpected would be the absence of a response. Right?
Yeah, it was my understanding that conventional warfare has specific frameworks or patterns of behavior that's not easy, but like that's pretty predictable. But because cyber warfare is partly new and partly because not a lot of people in government really understand what cyber warfare entails, even thinking that there'll be responses or something, or even characterizing something as aggression.
I grant you the first premise. It's new. That's the whole part of what we're doing here, is trying to understand the new in relation to the old. I'm not sure I grant the second premise at all. If you think that the governments, these governments in particular, are ignorant, I would caution you. The majority of people who really understand may not work for government, but a large plurality of the people who really understand work for government. And these governments have been thinking about cyber activities at every level for a very long time. They're not inexperienced. It's not new to them. Would it be sufficient to point to the relations between the Israelis and the Americans with respect to cyber activities in other parts of the Middle East? I mean, there are people whose hair is almost as gray as mine who have been doing this all the way along. I knew them when we were young. They're not experts. This isn't unfamiliar territory to them. It's undiscussed, but that doesn't make it unfamiliar. And no, I don't think that their understanding of the rules of escalation or the etiquette of violence is at all undeveloped. They're pretty good at it now, all of them. When the Chinese stole 112 million records of personnel containing people who had worked for the federal government, sought security classifications, all their families, and etc., one of the largest and most damaging pieces of data thievery in the big world over the last decade, the response of our NSA director, then General Alexander, was this was a valid intelligence target. If we could have done it to them, we certainly would. I think it is important to understand, I've referred to this before, that by the second Obama administration, the discussion among the world's leading parties, who then constituted, as far as they were concerned, the U.S., the European Union, and the Chinese, to the disadvantage of the Indian corner, which is always overlooked, and to the disadvantage of the Russians, who were then, as you would call them, a regional power, as Obama put it. But among the then top table players, by 2013 or 14, a fundamental agreement had been reached that there was no such thing as limitation on exfiltration. Everybody's listening was to occur in a worldwide free fire zone. The primary disagreement among those parties was over the question of breaking things, in which the European position was the American position will be our position, but it had better be that we don't break things without good reason and legal opportunity from United Nations resolutions or whatever. And the American decision maker most responsible for those discussions once characterized that European Union position as they follow us around with a ballpoint pen at the ready all the time in case on any given day we get ready to sign, which of course the Americans never were. And the Chinese position, which is anywhere there is a threat in the net, anywhere in the world, we have the right to go in and destroy it, and we consider ourselves empowered to do so, which was silently the American position, which was why that carefully cocked European ballpoint pen never got picked up by the Americans. So all of this was already 10 years ago a pretty clearly walked on pathway. The central bank sanctions announced over the weekend by the US and the Europeans are not cyber measures, right? They're above-the-line efforts to use legal powers granted to the states in the world financial system in an overtly hostile way designed to collapse the Russian economy. I don't think there's any major player in the world possessed of a good team who doesn't believe that under those circumstances you're entitled to respond. I don't think there's any political disagreement about it. So I'm not sure that it's a doctrinal uncertainty. And although I grant you the novelty of the thing, I don't think it's the novelty. I think it's just a question of power and time. And on that subject, which after all means what are the capabilities and intentions of the adversary, I think given everything that we can know in an unclassified world, and I'm not sure I know everything we can know in an unclassified world, but I know a substantial proportion of it, given what we know in the unclassified world, I would say their intentions are probably known to us and their capabilities are not yet certain. But it's actually a lot harder to overheat 350 centrifuges refining uranium hexafluoride under a mountain in Iran than to fuck up your damn smartphone banking applications. That's child's play. But my money is too small to be worth worrying about, so I'll be fine. It would at least be good to understand. But we can't understand because we can't read the code. We have no idea how stupid those apps are. I mean, should Russian tanks be running out of gas on the way to Kiev? It's important to understand that these systems were not built to protect themselves against this level of hostility. They just weren't. But they're very convenient, I hear. Anything else? Back to the 18th century? Hearing no objection. Still trying to read one sentence. As I pointed out, this sentence has changed meaning more drastically as a consequence of the process we call incorporation, that is, the application of the Bill of Rights to the states through Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, than any other part of the Bill of Rights, and yet the change occurs in a fashion which is so early to the process of incorporation that it never really seemed controversial. So in reading the 18th century sentence, we are required to observe that from the beginning of its role in this constitutional regime of ours, it was already under the process of transformation. As originally stated, Congress shall make no law respecting these issues. What we have is a principle of neutrality on the part of the imperial government, a concern about what might be done with its army. Once we have accommodated ourselves to the idea that this Congress means neither the federal legislature nor that of the states nor any of the state executive authorities or courts shall do any of these things, it becomes instead a charter for a particular form of societal organization, affecting not merely what the limits are on the coercive power of the federal army, but affecting what sort of society every part of the United States will be, and in a fashion which is indeed quite distinctive in the world. But that happens, if we can say that it happens, at a moment in Gitlo in 1927 when nobody is thinking that that's what's happening. And it is, in effect, inscribing the First Amendment on blank paper because, as I pointed out last time, such a society as this one, even with a federal army behind it, is inconceivable in a world of mass enslavement. And the United States of the 19th century, before 1865, could not conceivably have imagined such a society as this one. It would have required slavery to be destroyed. So we are reading this 18th century sentence, trying to understand what it meant, knowing that once we have acquired an understanding of what it meant, we are then going to sustain a historical transformation of a deeply important kind before we get to whatever that sentence has ever meant in the United States reports, since before 1919 it had no practical meaning of any kind, owing to the machinery which was necessary to maintain enslavement in the United States. When we stopped last time, I was here at that central comma, and we were trying to understand why the sentence speaks differently of the abridgment of freedom of speech or of the press. The argument I was laying out was that the consequence of a quite different line of English legal development results in this comma, that as it happens, the world of the English speakers' law developed in such a way as to take legal responsibility for words spoken and for words written or printed differently. I had so far gone as to indicate what the history was with respect to spoken words. That the idea of liability at law for damage done by words, primarily through defamation, was common to the late medieval, early modern English law, but that it came to be stringently limited because the royal courts preserved their jurisdiction by stringently limiting in a variety of ways, not limited to the jurisdictional amount in dispute, the total volume of defamation litigation they were prepared to work with. And if there were too many thief and whore cases, as indeed there always are, it fell to the royal courts to figure out ways to bang some of them out of court. The consequence of which was a series of doctrines with respect to harms by words spoken, which limited the reach of law and which limited the existence of coercive legal machinery for getting damages or other forms of recompense out of people who used words harmfully. On the other side of that comma, I was then about to say when I ran myself out of time last Wednesday, on the other side of that is a completely different regime with respect to the press. The ability to mass produce written documents is a crucial part of the technological package of European civilization, except, of course, it isn't European technology. But the adoption of the printing press and the ability to produce documents en masse using Chinese technology, which had quite different Chinese meaning, right? The adoption of movable type alphabetical printing in Europe at the end of the 15th century, mostly in the valley of the Rhine, and then exported outward as German industrial technology tends to do, the ability to print documents en masse in this technological form, using this machine, the press, poses for everybody the risk of political instability and destruction. This is partly a religious question, of course. The first and most important outcome of the adoption of that technology in Europe was the collapse of the Universal Catholic Church and the development of a fundamental set of lines across Europe between the speakers of Romance and Teutonic languages about religious worship and its meaning. But the Reformation, that substantial alteration in the European intellectual and religious environment, is only one part of what makes the press dangerous, of course. And so all European societies responded to the availability of the device, of the technology for mass production of written documents by control, stringent control. Control over who owns and uses presses and what happens to the documents that emerge from them. There are, of course, because the birth of the press occurs in the context of religious dissent, there are places, Geneva, or the other cities of the Rhine, or Ulm, or other places within the German lands. There are moments of some libertarianism, but they are inevitably crushed by the process of the efforts of the princes of the land and the Catholic Church to control printing. The Catholic Church, of course, has an idea about what to do, which is to ban books, to have an index censorum, to have a position about what can be printed and read by people within the Catholic world, as is characteristic of that form of activity by the Church. It worked rather poorly in Italy, in the homeland of the Church, and better in outlying areas of Catholic control in southern Europe. Within the world of the Protestant confession, as it came to be in the second half of the 16th century, control over the press by government tends to operate not by the prohibition, but by licensing. But by giving permission to certain people to own and operate presses. And only those people may operate presses, and then the works which emerge from those presses must be okayed for circulation. The revolt of the Dutch from Spanish control turned Amsterdam into a place of relatively free printing, even by the beginning of the 17th century, and completely by its end. The English abolished censorship unintentionally in 1679, intending to revive it almost any day now, and never quite achieving it. But the legacy of that experience lives on in the legal institutions of the English-speaking world under the assumption that press will be treated as a political as well as a legal matter. The Tudor monarchy, Henry VIII in particular, created as part of the process of revolutionizing English government a set of so-called conciliar courts. Those were organizations of judges and other political decision makers, largely using non-common law rules. Some of those rules are simply rules of the Roman law transplanted into English environment. That's admiralty, probate, divorce, and some other similar elements, which are treated not by common law courts, but by civil courts, politically constituted. But the most important of those conciliar tribunals, not the courts of the common law, not the courts of record of the common law, not using the common law forms of roles, not using common law rules of decision, but instead a political body making legal decisions, the most important of those in personnel and jurisdiction is a court which includes all the major judges of the common law courts, and the most important of the administrative royal servants, the chancellor and the other machinery of justice administrators. It met in a room in Westminster Hall, which, like Grand Central Station in New York City, was famous for its decorated ceiling. Like Grand Central Station, the decoration of this room in Westminster was a starry sky, a nightscape with constellations and the stars painted on it. And therefore the room was known as the Star Chamber. And there this conciliar court, beginning under Henry VIII and until the revolution against the British monarchy in 1649 came to be. Star Chamber then is simply the name of a court without a history, operating on a politically powerful basis with all the most important decision makers in the room, capable of doing whatever it wanted without having to go by a jury or with common law writs or common law rules. And one of the important purposes of Star Chamber is the governance of the press. The system of punishing and regulating publication in order to avoid sedition and political disturbance. A totally familiar process in the 21st century world, after all, as we've just been discussing. The consequence of this division, words spoken are dealt with by the common law courts in the ordinary way, except they really don't want to do it, and they make a bunch of rules so they won't have to. And the deep association of the printing press and of words written as subject to different rules, more political, and not based upon trying to get the cases out of court, but rather trying to get the dissenting interests, whatever that might be, religious or political, into court and punishing them for their publication, that difference leaves a distinctive but odd little gap in the English law between the quite different rules that evolve for words spoken and words written. As I explained last time, the royal courts take words spoken as a kind of lawsuit that you might not want to have, and you should make rules against it. Rules of innuendo, rules of special damage, rules that effectively say most forms of the use of words to hurt are just not important enough for us to do here. Whereas in libel, that is to say, actions based on the harm done by words in writing, there are no such rules of getting it out of the way. No such rules of innuendo, no rules of special damage. If the words are written as opposed to spoken, then a whole different regime of regulation applies to them. This produces a number of rather complicated and at least theoretically very interesting problems in the English law. It would be good to point out that those are long-lasting. So, does it matter whether the words were spoken or written? Yes, it absolutely matters. It will matter in the way in which, even after 1649, when Star Chamber isn't there anymore and all of this is back in the common law courts, it will matter because it's much easier to bring an action over words written than words spoken, and for no reason other than historical distinction. The great English legal comedian, I recognize that you might not have been aware that that was even a genre, let alone that there were excellences in it. It's one of the things wrong, I think, with law school, is that the literature of legal humor is barely touched upon in law school. But the greatest of the 20th century English legal comedians, A.P. Herbert, who was also a writer of musical comedy, A.P. Herbert had a long-running column in the English humor magazine Punch. And by long running, I mean decades running, in the middle of the 20th century, called Misleading Cases in the Common Law, in which Herbert would make up and document in the form of sham judicial opinions interesting problems with law and its absurdities. And Herbert was a specialist in the distinction between libel and slander as a fertile field of English comedy. The question in the classic case of Chicken Against Ham, whether a phonograph recording was libel or slander. Chicken had a set of mass store supermarkets, and Ham had a grievance against Chicken. And Ham recorded a defamatory Christmas message and sent the disc to Chicken, who put it on the gramophone, played it before his family on Christmas morning, and was pissed off by Ham's slanging of Chicken on the recording. And so Herbert imagines the lawsuit going to the House of Lords over whether a gramophone record is libel or slander. On the one hand, it's fixed in a tangible medium of expression, as the American copyright law says. On the other hand, the noises that were defamatory to Chicken came out the horn of the Victrola and disappeared into the air. In the course of post-developing Chicken Against Ham, Herbert imagined the case of skywriting defamatory to a parliamentary candidate. Was the skywriting libel because it was written words, or was it slander because it blew away in the air after having been written up there? In the course of Lord Sheep's declaration in the case of the parliamentary candidate, a case which Herbert never actually reported at length, but which I have always hoped I would stumble upon the report of, Herbert refers to the case of Wart against the Stepney Guardians, in which Wart had trained his parrot to say at meals, "Counselor Wart has not washed today." And according to Herbert, the House of Lords ultimately had decided that the parrot was slander, not libel, because although the parrot was a physical thing, and it repeated the message. Still, the words of the parrot were mere air, etc. So all of Herbert's effort at satire was ultimately crowned in the late year 1968, when in a reform of libel law, Parliament finally obliterated the distinction between libel and slander. But in 1791, so one part of the reason for this difference, from a historical point of view, is simply to say that for any English-speaking lawyer of the late 18th century, it comes naturally to think about the question of the legal application to words spoken and words written or printed as different, as necessary to say both. You can't say only one because they're two different legal regimes and you need to specify both of them. And so at one part of our effort to interpret what the First Amendment says, we are merely watching a distinction which has purely historical relevance in the English law, but which makes every English-speaking lawyer think that you need to assert at any given moment that you mean both things, words spoken and words printed. We could also, justifiably, with respect to 18th century British North Americans, say that this is about a liberty of speech, that is, a right to say things in public, and that this is about a right of publication, and that they are different. It is possible to offer that categorization to say that in addition to being a reference to two different legal regimes, which can't be confused because in every lawyer's mind they're different, you could also locate a category here. But it would be reasonable to notice that that's not the way the syntax of the sentence really functions. Everything about which legislative abridgment may not occur is two sets of rights. And each of those two rights are divided into two parts. The syntax of the sentence is symmetrical with respect to the idea that you can't abridge freedom of speech or of the press on the one hand, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition government for redress of grievances on the other. And the actual grammar of the sentence, as long as you refuse to engage in clausification, the actual grammar of the sentence is to say, what are these? That they should be two things with two parts each. And this brings us closer to the distinction, which is the one that, for example, Justice Black and the Supreme Court are capable of dealing with in Tinker against Des Moines. You remember, that's the armbands in school case. You remember, it's children saying no to war on armbands that they wear to school. 5,000 people were arrested in Russia last week for this, right? We were then a country at war. We dropped burning jelly gasoline on the heads of other people's children. That was the country I grew up in. Some of us didn't like it. Some of us who didn't like it were children. And we went to school and said, we don't like it. And the Supreme Court made a distinction, as you will recall in Tinker, about the difference between speech and conduct, and which found the wearing of the armbands to be conduct rather than speech. Thus explaining, well, I mean, of course, we didn't throw them in the back of a van and beat them. But you know how much you want to bend over backward to keep things off your personal record in school. So what if we looked at the 18th century sentence and we said, yes, indeed, here is speech and there is conduct. And the imperial army shall not be authorized by legislation to abridge any of it, speech or conduct. Now it begins to make sense. In fact, it makes more sense than clausifying the thing and asking what does the petition clause do. It addresses itself to the working problem of the judge, in fact. For all his Pilgrim's freeing oppression stuff, Hugo Black was wrong about this, it seems fairly clear to me. But hard decisions are made in wartime. So let us say then, for the moment, subject to all the arguments you could offer against this, in which at the moment you don't seem interested in offering, let us say then that we can give an 18th century construction to this, which makes sense. It's important to observe for the moment then that this phrase is without social meaning. In the 20th century, when the mass production of information was at its industrial height, when printing a newspaper and delivering it in trucks to newsstands and radio broadcasting and all the various other forms of publication were at their most industrial and therefore their most capital intensive, if you read this incontinently, or at least in too clausified a fashion, you could come up with the idea which Potter Stewart fundamentally offered both on the Supreme Court and in his so-called scholarly writing. You could come up with the idea that the press is not a phrase meaning a thing made of wood and metal, or metal and metal, and not merely the publishing act of individuals or another form of words, but rather the name of a privileged set of human beings who had a right to be the press. This is, after all, the leading late 20th century theory of what this means. That the Constitution gives the press a right, the right to be the press. And therefore, what are the rights of the press, namely the Sulzberger family, you know, the owners of it? The great American press reporter and writer H.A. Liebling said in 1927, the freedom of the press belongs to him who owns one. And by the late 20th century, the people who owned one were busily saying that the press was, in effect, a constitutional caste with rights. You could call them special, but you certainly had to call them rights. If you think about it, the Pentagon Papers is essentially the high watermark of that position. A case in which the right of the press to report free of the forms of effort previous to publication, prior restraint, is the subject of the constitutional adjudication. What does the New York Times have the right to print? And the justices, at least so far as we can tell from the internal deliberations materials disclosed by the brethren, or more importantly by Superchief, go about the task of asserting for themselves what is the right of the press to report. The location of ships in wartime? No. The disposition of troops? No. The historical material concerning how we got to Vietnam, yes. And all of this on the basis of what amounts to an assertion about the extent of the rights of the press as an institution. If that's the high watermark of the discussion, the near contemporaneous case, KQED against Houchins, is the line of external limitation. Does the press have a right of access constitutionally to prisons and other governmental locales? If the Supreme Court says no, as it does, then that's apparently beyond the privilege of the caste. The good news is we can do away with that altogether. If we read it right, we are not privileging the Sulzberger family or Rupert Murdoch or any other lord of the press as a special constitutional actor, the Fourth Estate. Of course, that was the view of the great powers of established mass media in the United States at the end of the 20th century, and they loved nothing more than sending Floyd Abrams to the Supreme Court to represent them as a special bunch of people with special responsibilities for the maintenance of democracy and freedom, engaged in using the special constitutional rights given to them by the First Amendment. I never particularly liked that way of thinking about it, but it's also just no good. On the other hand, this is part of why our experience with the First Amendment in the 21st century is not tragic, but comic. Why the First Amendment adapts itself far better to our existing challenges than the Fourth Amendment does, because indeed all it's talking about is the machine of publication. And the machine of publication, well, it isn't a thing of wood and metal anymore. It's a thing of silicon and battery power. The press, as you are well aware, well, I mean, it could be your laptop, but maybe even. Because after all, what really happened was that speech almost disappeared. I noticed that some people, but just consider how almost disappeared it was. Particularly because nobody loved Twitter more than journalists. Because the adoption of a form of publishing power which was unhindered by capitalism, at least as they saw it, because it wasn't their bosses, was of such enormous importance to people who wrote for a living. And everybody else? Well, they got really shy. You remember how it was. You didn't like telephone calls anymore. People just swiped left and swiped right instead of spending all the evening on the telephone with one another. People would rather break up by text message. I knew that a thing of deep importance in the world had happened in 2014 when a Qualcomm executive, a legal executive in San Diego, in a meeting we were having, mentioned along the way that his daughter, who was 12, had just broken up with her best friend that morning by text message when they were sitting on the same school bus. And in 2012, that seemed a very important, you know, hallmark of the coming changes in human society. By 2016, it was so common nobody even noticed it. The ability to publish, that is, to move written words from one place to another without friction and to share them with pretty much anybody who wanted them, was a power granted to humanity in the last 15 years. It was granted, like most deals from the devil, under terrible conditions and with a deep deceptiveness about what it meant and what it would accomplish. When I said in 2009 that Zuckerberg had done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age, I was, of course, speaking in the full knowledge that Jack Dorsey would always be older than Mark Zuckerberg. And it's important to understand just how much harm to the human race Dorsey did. But the primary mechanism, despite his bullshit pseudo-intellectual nonsense about Twitter being the free speech movement's free speech end, the fundamental underlying mechanism of it was to take advantage, in a vampiric sense, of humans' desire to publish. A desire which is not the same as the desire to be heard, and which was granted to the human race on condition loss of soul. But we can at least be sure that if those words are to be understood as relating to a thing, then the thing they now relate to is the net that binds us all. As we can be sure that it does not relate to a specific privileged set of human beings, such that the cases should go on decade after decade asking whether this or that blogger is the press for this or that purpose, or whether it is acceptable for the White House press pool to consist only of people who are not bloggers, whatever that is. Indeed, whether it is acceptable for government to adopt a form of organization of the way it speaks to society which discriminates unequally between rich people with this kind of printer and poor people with that kind of printer. And this opens the subject that I want to discuss in full detail next time, which is why there is a principle of equality that is fundamentally built into the First Amendment. For now, I'm not stating the argument, I'm stating the conclusion only, that if the First Amendment implies a form of equality to the level made possible by the technologies of communication, then broadcasting was always unconstitutional. Then it was always unconstitutional to say that Rupert Murdoch gets the right to reach 68 million people and I get the right to reach 12. That if government is in itself responsible for creating such substantial disparities in the ability to speak or to write, then government is itself responsible for not doing it anymore. That is the conclusion I shall try and support next week, but for the moment all I want to show is that it's consistent with, not inconsistent with, any fundamental attempt to read the language as it is written before us on the page. Questions, comments, or assertions now? Well, that's a very different First Amendment than the one that somebody else would have offered to you with quotations from John Milton and so on. It's law stuff, deeply embedded in the history of law stuff, conservatively used in order to limit what a new set of legislators and uniformed personnel may do in a new society being constructed in the 1790s, fundamentally reconstructed in the 1920s, and in its new form declaring that this will be, from top to bottom, a society in which law will not be used for these purposes, which is, as I say, both unique of its kind and profoundly destabilizing to other forms of political assumption around the world. Distinctive, exceptional maybe even. And yet, in no way architecturally required. The First Amendment could have continued to mean that Congress shall make no law. It doesn't arise there by force of, oh my God, we incorporated everything else, shall we incorporate the Seventh Amendment too? No, that's a bridge too far. Not this logic of argument between Felix Frankfurter and Hugo Black, or between Hugo Black and Professor Fairman. This just happened. It's true that it happened because the New York anti-syndicalism statute was hard to square with some broad general understanding of the way the union ought to work. But the incorporation of the First Amendment is an accidental revolution with respect to most of its consequences. And what we now live with as we try and apply it in the age of the net has nothing to do with the politics of its origin, only with the law of its origin. Because to incorporate all of this against every local school district and every university and every police department and every town council in the United States is to make a statement not about the power, limited powers of the federal government, but about the textural essence of what it's like to be in America instead of somewhere else. which allows us a lot more freedom when the time comes to consider what we have wrought in these machines of ours and in their ability to expand our communications and the breadth of our culture. Let us take a sufficiently unimportant example of no social meaning, whatever, that is pornography. The obscene, from the point of view of the First Amendment of the 19th century, can be easily described. It is unspeakably obscene to advocate the abolition of slavery, the freedom of black people, or the education of black people by the teaching of them to read in the public schools. All of those things are obscene in 19th century United States, and the males don't allow you to use them. Right? It's forbidden stuff. Stuff that children should not be taught, like, say, critical race theory. It's an example of that which it is beyond the decencies of society to permit. And it's not really all that surprising, in a way, that after 1865 and the passage of the 13th Amendment, when that was no longer what the United States government barred from the males, what it barred from the males instead was obscenity, sexual material, and material concerning abortion under the Comstock Acts of the 1880s. You could think of them in that sense as obscenity moving itself from the question of race to the question of sex, and eventually finding its way back, of course, as always, in the United States, to the color line and its constitutional importance. But the sexual material itself, I mean, you know, who cares? And yet, an awful lot of 20th century First Amendment life came to be directed around exactly this question, the obscene. That which was sexually too far away from what was okay to be permitted in the public sphere, in the mails, on the newsstands, even, as we discover later on, in a movie theater up on the second floor of a building with no street-level advertising of what it is showing of any kind. Now, at one level, in order to have that concept of the obscene, there needed to be a first step, which was an understanding that there is some kind of speech or writing that lies outside this protection of the First Amendment. And from almost the moment at which the First Amendment gains incorporation and begins to be applied in all those pieces in United States society, the issue is the discovery of restraints, of words that aren't really words, of things that shouldn't really be protected. And obscenity is, in that sense, not the first. The first is the doctrine evolved out of God knows where in Chaplinsky against New Hampshire in 1946. You recall, that's the one in which the guy tries to stop the tank. Well, actually, it's not a tank, it's just a policeman. But he tries to stop the policeman the way somebody this week might be trying to stop the tank. He yells fascist and goddamned racketeer at the policeman. Now, the man doing that is a Jehovah's Witness, so he is, of course, not a real person. He's a something else, a not quite human being, because his beliefs are wrong. But his beliefs are that the people who have been burning Jehovah's Witnesses out of their houses and stores across New England in the middle of the Second World War are engaged in an activity which is fascism and racketeering. He's not wrong about it. The fact that one of the members of a crowd burning a family of Jehovah's Witnesses out of their store and home in Kennebunkport, Maine in 1943 was one young Marine, George H.W. Bush, was one of the great things we couldn't talk about in the United States while the cigarette butt pilot was president. But that moment in Chaplinsky where the Supreme Court allows the conviction of Chaplinsky for back-chatting the cop on the grounds that his words were fighting words and thus lie outside the First Amendment altogether, is the beginning of that cursed tradition of things that are outside the First Amendment. In 1948, as you recall, it was commercial speech that lay outside the domain of the First Amendment. Why? Well, because Manhattan. The New York City Police Commissioner, always a very powerful force even when he isn't the mayor, the New York Police Commissioner had the right to prevent people from handing out pamphlets on the street. Why did he have that right? Well, it goes back to the socialists and the anti-selective service riots of 1919. But that wasn't what Christensen was doing. He was simply preventing a guy named Valentine from handing out leaflets on the street which said, "Come see my submarine for a dime." Valentine had bought a surplus submarine, and he was showing it on the East River over where Donald Trump was later going to build the tallest building in the world at the South Street Seaport. And he wants to hand out on 14th Street a whole bunch of leaflets that say, "Come see my submarine for a dime." And the police commissioner says no, and the Supreme Court says, "Yeah, that's okay, because it was just commercial speech. And commercial speech lies outside the domain of the First Amendment." Not as it turns out, an eternal ruling, overruled in 1975 and now treated as a mistake of some sort. But if you take fighting words plus commercial speech outside the domain of the First Amendment, then it is easy in 1953 in Roth against the United States to say, and the obscene. And the obscene. So let's ask then about the obscene, right? I mean, it's just commercial speech. Or else it isn't. And if it is, then it's not important because it's just sleazy business. And if it's not, that it's really very political at all indeed, and we should be damn careful about it because it's offensive. And thus we begin a long and ultimately horrific attempt to do all sorts of work under the First Amendment by ruling out obscenity. And by the time I was becoming a lawyer, we were pretty much having to give up on that, although Warren Berger really hated the thought of it. But a district judge in New York City held, as part of the general community standards inquiry in 1982, that the community standards of New York City is anything goes. And the Second Circuit deeply repudiated the opinion in an opinion written by Thomas Meskel, formerly the governor of Connecticut, whose basic attitude is, well, that may be true in Sodom, but it's not true in the Second Circuit. And I thought, gee, that's too bad. I thought that was a pretty good ruling, because indeed that is what we think around here, is it not? And that brought us to begin to ask the question, well, what really is the community for which Miller against California came up? You will have noticed that all of this is hardly worth discussing anymore. Among the parties sanctioning the Russians last week, you noticed, was Pornhub. If only Aristophanes could come back, because it's Lysistrata, degenerate 21st century structure, right? No Pornhub for the Russians until they get out of Ukraine. We, in other words, altered all of this completely. We altered it. I mean, the people altered it, because any discussion about the community standards with respect to the obscene, well, I mean, we decided. We connected everybody on Earth to the net. And we connected everybody's genitals to the net, and we connected everybody's imaginations to the net, and the idea of government in control of, not true. I mean, if you've had any experience with the Saudi net, you know that it is indeed possible completely, to eliminate pornography from the internet. But in reality, of course, we exploded the taboos. And that explosion is the consequence of the democratization of the ability to publish. And that democratization of the ability to publish produces, on legal theory in the United States and indeed in more repressive societies around the world, the determination to declare victory and to get out. And never actually to test the force of coercion against the people on this subject anymore. It may not be an exhilarating, or even if it is an exhilarating, it's not necessarily an edifying form of reaching the conclusion, but the conclusion is valid and really important anyway. What we ultimately decided for when we incorporated the First Amendment was a society in which those forms of control cannot exist. And the net decentralized, the decision-making about both publishing and reading to a point at which, well, to a point at which it was possible to surveil the pornography habits of everybody government disliked. I'm not sure why you let them do that either. It's just another example of the same technological surrender. The production of compromat for every desiring government. But it didn't have to be that way. It's another example of that second decade of the 21st century twist, in which we ultimately adopted the position of a society that thinks everybody should read everything, just as long as everybody can spy on what everybody reads. But that latter part had nothing to do with government. Government didn't do that to you, you did that to yourselves. So in this process, then, the obscene becomes a minor functional model of the larger question of what happens when society devises technology for the elimination of its taboos and the destruction of its political limitations in culture. And of course, the answer is all societies other than that of the United States find themselves warding it off to one extent or another. It only takes a moment of trying to understand what the British Parliament is currently up to come to the conclusion that a First Amendment is an unthinkable imposition on parliamentary supremacy, just as Parliament in the 18th century would have thought it was, but for very other reasons. And I will, of course, point out that even in the United States, nobody has ever taken this right at all seriously with respect to the people we condescendingly refer to as children. Although it should be absolutely evident that in this society, people called children have as much right to read as everybody else, we have never actually considered for an instant allowing that to become the necessary consequence of our commitments to our own freedom. We are always busy taking it away from children. Which is why it becomes possible to censor books in public school libraries. Because, after all, children don't have a right to read obscene things like Mouse, or obscene things like The Bluest Eye. The desire to keep in place the idea that we know and can exercise a power to limit the right to know or the right to imagine or the right to conceive, we leave children as the kind of symbolic hostages. And if I actually open the room up to discussion and we discuss whether children have an absolute right to read, I may be the only person here who believes they do. It wouldn't be an atypical classroom. But that's for another day and another time, of course, because the very idea that children have constitutional rights is an iffy kind of proposition. But let's, for the moment at any rate, recognize that there's nothing here that justifies any of those propositions. If Congress shall make no law means nobody shall make no law, then it means that about everybody, everywhere, all the time. And that is an extraordinary human commitment a social view very unusual across the whole range of human history, and powerfully equipped in the net we made originally to have absolutely revolutionary consequences throughout humanity. It's why I don't want the First Amendment to turn out to be a tragedy, of course, because the revolution's here, not there. Not about who can be arrested and thrown in the back of a van, not about how police searching is done, not about whether cops can lie. This is the center of the revolution of importance to the human race in the 20th century. More about anything? Questions, assertions, comments? Really? Not even on my dreadful proposition that children have a right to read? You're willing to sign up for that because it's just too much trouble to fight about on late on Wednesday afternoon? So let us move then to the question, what is abridging, once again? The word is in itself improbable. For a language of law to talk about prohibiting or laws respecting or violating the rights of but abridging, it demonstrates both that the drafter is in need of a word, and that we should pay particular attention to the word that the legislator uses. It's a literate word, as I pointed out before, and a legal one. But the literate meaning of abridgment, to shorten, or the legal meaning of abridgment, to collect from disparate sources and to put briefly into an organizational form, both are resonant here, but they're not operative. They're not what's doing the work. What's doing the work is the larger sense of the verb, to interfere with, not merely to shorten, but to truncate, to bowdlerize, to edit, to censor, to black out. And in that sense, also, to make unequal. To abridge is to shorten in one place and to leave unshortened in something else, to make editorial decisions about extent. Here, more than anywhere else, is the original linguistic demonstration that some principle of equality is required here. Everybody gets the same amount of the freedom of speech. It's not abridged. It's not edited. It's not subject. And of course, if we think about it in the original context, the First Congress saying federal troops will not be used, that's what it means. Don't abridge. And if we think about how it failed in the first half of the 19th century, then of course it's the abridgment that it usually is. This for white folks, that for black folks. For them, the state constitutional amendments that say there shall be public education for all, except for those for whom there shall be no education, public or otherwise, those for whom the learning of reading shall be prohibited. That's what abridgment means. And so, as usual, we find those two American constitutional traditions in useful dialogue with one another. What is really being objected to, after all, is the abridgment of these rights for us. As Frederick Douglass said when his owner tried to teach him to read and her husband interfered, "Now I know for the first time," this 8-year-old genius says, or rather recollects in later life about his 8-year-old genius self, "this is when I understood for the first time the secret of the white man's power over the black man, the abridgment of his freedom of speech and press. He can't read a newspaper. He can't learn to read. And teaching him is a criminal offense." Equality is built into this. Equality is built into this because inequality is what it prohibits. And not only prohibits, but discovers. After all, it is the federal government. It is Congress making a law that says no abolition material in the U.S. Post. That is inequality at work. As it is inequality at work now that those who have only Russian state television to listen to are not aware that there's a war in Ukraine or that soldiers will come home in their thousands in body bags. That's abridgment. Censorship is one way to describe it, but that's not what's being described here. That word would have been available to them, although it would have seemed a little odd. It was at least Roman and therefore classically grand. But this isn't about censorship. This isn't about any particular levying of any particular point of view. This is about the fact of abridgment in itself. The existence of shorter and longer forms, more over here and less over there. That to say that this is about Rupert Murdoch is no more correct than to say that this is about slavery. But it is to say that the long history of the United States is a dialogue about this question. The abridgment of those rights. And my plea for children's right to read is just the same. It's the abridgment I'm objecting to. The fully incorporated, now socially applicable, not federally applicable First Amendment, then comes to have this great relevance in the world of our net. What forms of abridgment, inequality in freedom of speech or the press are allowed when the technical justifications for allowing them no longer exist? This was, after all, the condition, actual or potential, of the United States by the middle of the 1990s. If you look at my Invisible Barbecue from 1997, it is already old for me, if really annoying to people at Symposia of the Columbia Law Review, to say that broadcasting is facially unconstitutional in the technical circumstances in which we now live. I can remember when I was the only insane person who publicly would take such a position. Then there was Larry Lessig, then there were two of us, then there was Yochai, then there were three of us. Then some of the guys on the other side started to get converted, and by the first decade of the 20th century, people who used to think I was crazy still thought I was crazy, but they were on my side now, having learnedly done all the calculus and buried themselves in the law and economics chalk dust and discovered that, yes, it was really hard to understand how those government privileges could be justified. But there isn't any justification. The awarding of deeply unequal privileges of communication when there's no poverty or scarcity of spectrum or all those other arguments have gone away, when it is perfectly obvious that everybody can have a television station, that everybody can have a radio station, that everybody can have a newspaper, that all of these acts can be equalized, and that it is government force, the activity of spectrum allocation, the decisions of administrators about who's allowed to speak on which frequencies, at which powers, at which times of day, all of that becomes technologically no longer really necessary. It's no longer scarcity, it's just reason, just logic, just words left over. Now, of course, that has consequences that are not necessarily the ones that people like. You could call one of them Citizens United and the other one Red Lion Broadcasting against FCC, if you want. No fairness doctrine, no principle of the utility of restrictions on information as adding to the integrity of the political or electoral system, etc., etc. But still, the question arises. The court in Red Lion, Justice White and all his colleagues in the majority, seem to think that the reason the fairness doctrine can exist is that the spectrum is scarce, and only that. And the spectrum's scarce only in the relative sense. Everybody's endpoints can fit within the existing spectrum. But this raises, as we shall see next time, a further question. All of you have the right to publish. Who gave Zuckerberg the right to control everybody's publications? What process of law resulted in this extraordinary regime in which you sort of have a television station, but he sort of owns it? In which the technological facilities for the equalization of communications have been used not to create equalization, but disequalization. In which those powers, which are sometimes co-opted by government in various interesting ways, in deals which universally benefit both government and the platform and universally disbenefit the individual users. And we need to spend a little bit of time on the questions of secrecy, encryption, on our power to speak secretly, and on politics' benefit from the power to speak secretly. It is true that the psychology of human understanding, which lies in the 18th century sentences, lies on the other side of the great idea that we call Freud. The majority of human mental activity is unconscious. Tons of stuff has been written, particularly in the 20th century, as though this were a sentence about rational deliberation and thoughtful citizens engaged in Jeffersonian politics, and that's bullshit. Because, of course, what was democratized was something both bigger and smaller. Access to the world of the unconscious of everybody. Before Narendra Modi, the last general election before Narendra Modi was a national politician. My law partner and I were talking to a head of the BJP IT cell as it then existed. We were talking about the last grand state elections in the preceding cycle in Karnataka. In which, as our informant in the BJP told us, there had been 80,000 WhatsApp channels used by BJP in the Karnataka election alone. Now, it's true, Karnataka is a very small place. There's only 49 million people in it, the same size roughly as West Germany. But a small state election, anyway. 80,000 WhatsApp channels. That is 80,000 fully encrypted ways of communicating with chosen endpoints identified by BJP through the psychographic data offered them from WhatsApp. Oh, said our informant, we have learned that there's really no point in using short message campaigning addressed to the conscious thinking of the voters. But the power of our messaging addressed to the unconscious thinking of the voters, he said. Opaque channels of communication, end-to-end encrypted, is the result of horrible behavior by people like me who wanted everybody on Earth to be able to encrypt things, even though that was going to allow pedophilia and nuclear terrorism, according to our opponents. 80,000 fully obscure channels of communication directed by an institution to particular individuals whose unconscious motivations for acting and behaving and voting and committing violence could be reached by careful study of the data on those individuals available from the communications parties who had unequal access to the thoughts of billions of people. I suppose you could say that nothing was abridged, but something was deeply and cancerously enlarged. And here we are. And we have seen Donald Trump, the President of the United States, and Tsar Vladimir, the Tsar of all the Russias except the ones he hasn't conquered yet. And we have learned something. And the First Amendment will still be here with us next week. Thank you very much.